This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, welcome to The Country Hour across South Australia and Broken Hill. I'm Cassie Huff, and recent rain sure has buoyed the hopes of Australian farmers after a dry start to the season this year. But the fertiliser price hasn't been quite so attractive. I'll explain more on what's behind this fertiliser price rise. And after a couple of smaller crops in recent years, lucerne seed demand is booming.
I've been in this job for 7, 8 years. I have not seen it where it's been so tight, and that from June, so probably July, August, I don't see that there'll be any public lucerne seed to sell other than maybe a little bit of uncertified.
Everyone's getting their fodder crops in. I'll have more on that seed crop soon. But first, to tractor sales. Now, we've been following this a lot on The Country Hour, and it seems that this spending spree on new tractors across the country is continuing, despite some supply challenges and the end of the federal government's instant asset write-off scheme looming. Now, in the last year, 15,700 tractors have been sold. That's up 37% on the previous 12 months. Cara Jaffery spoke to Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover about what's driving this buoyant farm machinery market.
Well, they're still booming, Cara, to be honest. We have been quite surprised by the strength of the market over the past few months. We thought we'd hit a record level sort of earlier in the year. May has certainly topped that again.
And so looking at the latest report that you've put out for May, looks as though New South Wales is still leading the charge year to date with sales up 78% for tractors and 30% on the same month last year. So I guess why are sales so good in New South Wales?
I think there was certainly a period there back in 2019 in particular where that market was very depressed. So a lot of destocking occurred in agricultural businesses. So there has been a fair bit of catch-up in play there. No doubt the market's been healthy. The environment and the weather conditions have been very strong through 2020, which has led to this current demand. But if you go back a year or two before that, there was certainly a bit of catch-up being in play there.
And when you drilled down on the figures, when you did look at how sales were going, were there any states that also surprised you on how well they were doing?
Look, to be honest with you, they've all been very surprising on the upside. Certainly been aware of the impact of the government's instant asset write-off scheme, and that's due to come to an end in June. So we figured, well, there's a lot of demand being absorbed by that. But that's now being continued for another 2 years. So there shouldn't be any panic on the front of buyers to go and take advantage of that, because it's certainly a scheme that's going to continue on. Supply issues have been a challenge. Dealers have been reporting that they've been running low on stocks and haven't always been able to meet the demand of their customers. So the fact that all states really are still humming along at these levels has been very surprising.
And are there any particular ranges of tractors that are really in demand at the moment?
Look, the little ones are have always been strong through this period. So anything up to 100 horsepower has been very healthy. The larger ones, above 100 and even above 200 horsepower, tend to be less, not I want to use the word impulse buy, but they're bought on more of a planned approach, whereas perhaps buyers have been seeing an opportunity to acquire smaller tractors, get the tax write-off and keep going. So that's certainly been a strong part of the market.
And are you hearing from dealers and then buyers a bit further along the chain that there are supply issues getting the gear into Australia and it's taking a long time from the order date to actually arrive on the farm?
Yeah, look, that's been an issue for some time now. So the sales that we're seeing now have been driven by, stock that was ordered perhaps November, December, January earlier this year. But anything that's been ordered since that time certainly is on a much longer lead time. So dealers are just proving to be a bit reluctant to quote specific delivery times at the moment, because there's just so much uncertainty out there. So it hasn't really played out in today's figures, but there's certainly plenty of indications that that it will in the not too distant future.
But it's not stalling the buy up too much, though. People are still buying up, even though they know that they'll have a bit of a wait.
Well, look, you know, we keep wondering about how much longer this can go because, you know, we're not building new farms necessarily in this country, and there's got to be a point of saturation where the market can only sell so many machines. So, yes, we're seeing customers perhaps buying, you know, there would have been a list of product that they've said must-haves, and there may also have been a list of like-to-haves or a wish list that people have been spending against. So at some point we think that's just got to slow down, so it can't be too far away.
Is there any reason that the dealers are being told why the supply is delayed? Is it because of COVID-related issues, getting, you know, items on ships and getting them into Australia and through the ports? What are they being told?
Well, look, it's a range of issues. We're seeing certainly Australia's market coinciding with an improvement in the worldwide situation. So, yeah, this is what we're seeing in Australia, not much different to what's happening in the US and Europe. So demand out of factories has gone up across the board. So it's not just Australia. There have been certainly issues with supply of raw materials, steel and tyres and the like. So there's been many reports of delays and price increases in some of those components. And no doubt the shipping delays are really starting to show themselves. Clearly, there's been a real flood of imports to this country, not just of agricultural equipment, but everything from motor vehicles to building materials and the like. So our ports have become bottlenecks, and that's caused further delays down the supply chain. So it really is a combination of all of those things, to be honest.
And as you mentioned, the federal government's instant asset write-off scheme is coming to an end shortly, with the temporary full expensing scheme replacing it for 2 years. So do you think this will help keep those sales of new gear, keep that ticking over?
Well, it certainly would be supportive of that, providing the demand's still there. Clearly, we feel that there was a bit of a push towards taking advantage of the instant asset write-off scheme, which concludes the end of June. So maybe the level of demand might come off a bit. We think that whilst the temporary full expensing scheme will be supportive, we think a lot of people have probably taken advantage of the scheme as it is, and there's only so much they can do.
As Tractor and Machinery Association of Australia Executive Director Gary Northover speaking to Carl Jeffrey. And here in South Australia, the TMA is saying that tractor sales here increased 34% for May compared to the same month last year. So people are still buying up big time when it comes to tractors, and the federal government's instant tax write-off scheme has been quite a big driver behind that. That is coming to an end. If that has driven your interest, I'd love to know about it. You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891, because, yeah, 34% increase on the same month last year is a pretty big increase. So hopefully there's some new tractors running around in South Australia. But while we're talking about tractors, they're often used for putting in crop, and it seems that there's a demand from the Northern Hemisphere for fertiliser that has really pushed up prices for what's being sent here, for the fertiliser being shipped to Australia. That's at least according to Thomas Elder Market's Andrew Whitelaw, who estimates that DAP fertiliser, DAP fertiliser, has risen by $199 a tonne since the beginning of the year. Urea has also increased by $148 a tonne in the same time. Mr. Whitelaw says fertiliser prices are poorly understood in Australia, despite how important they are to farmers' bottom lines.
Part of it is supply and demand. Like, most prices move with supply and demand, and that's the reality. And so what we see at the moment is we see like a really close relationship between things like the price of corn increasing, flowing through to the price of things like urea and DAP. And the cynic could say, oh, it's about capacity to pay. So, you know, a higher corn price means that farmers have got more money, so we can charge a bit more. But there is actually a bit of logic behind that occurring, and that is that, you know, with a higher grain price, it means that farmers are more likely to put as much sort of fertilizer down as they can afford to, but it also means there's going to be a lot more acreage around the world which actually gets planted. So therefore, the demand for fertilizer starts to increase.
How does this compare to, I suppose, the long-term average?
Looking at, urea, we've only simulated this back for the last, 4.5 years. And we did reach sort of quite similar levels back in probably about September of 2018. And then prices fell, but it's at very high levels for the last 4.5 years. And DAP is especially high. We're going to be nowhere near that in the last 4.5 years. And when we look back really like at international values, we're really talking with DAP being almost the highest level since, you know, the late 2000s, and the urea being at the sort of the highest level since, you know, the early part of the last decade. So very strong pricing levels.
So based on what you've seen so far, do you have any indication of, I suppose, what we might be expecting out of the fertilizer market within the next couple of months?
Look, talking to a lot of analysts around the world about fertilizer, the market is being pushed up by very strong demand at present for fertilizer, mainly from the Northern Hemisphere. And we think as supply comes on stream in the coming months, we expect that there will be probably a bit of a softening of prices in the second half of the year. So we'll just have to wait and see, and fingers crossed that does occur. And hopefully things like shipping rates fall in price, which will reduce the cost of us receiving that fertilizer. But at the moment, it's extremely expensive. And we can just hope that that softening does occur.
When you've measured these prices, this is not a exact measurement of the cost of fertilizer versus the commodities as they were on that day, because I think you explained to me before that the fertilizer prices are not as transparent as you would like. Would you mind explaining that, please?
Well, in Australia, there's not like an easy way to get access to, you know, a price for fertilizer in Australia. It's not like grain prices or meat prices where you can, you know, you get your daily text, or you can go onto numerous websites to find that information. For instance, you can get, you know, your lamb and cattle pricing off of the MLA website, or your wool pricing for AWI. For fertilizer, it's not quite as open and transparent. It's a little bit more opaque. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to bring a little bit more transparency to that marketplace. And so what we've sort of developed in conjunction with an organization called CRU is a bit of a theoretical model, which is quite, sounds complicated, but it's actually quite simple. It's the price of the fertilizer, how much it would cost to purchase at the origin. So Saudi Arabia for urea and China for DAP. Converted into Aussie dollar, and then a freight component added on top to basically get it to the shores of Australia. So whilst there's other costs to be included in it, like local logistics, administration, and retailing costs, and margin, it gives us a closer idea of what the price should be in Australia than we've probably had before, and what we've actually publicly had available for the general public to look at.
Thomas Elder Markets analyst Andrew Whitelaw speaking to Lucas Forbes there about the price rise in fertiliser that's been seen across Australia this year. You're listening to The Country Hour. I'm Cassie Huff, and it is 18 minutes past 12.
Now, where was I up to in Wakefield? Wait, I can set up a free ABC account. Charlie Pickering. Too easy. So from July, we'll need to log in to stream shows on ABC iView. You'll still get all the same great content that's already on ABC iView, and you'll get recommendations based on what you watch, so it's easier to find the content you love.
For more information about your free ABC account, head to abc.net.au/abc account.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
I am Cassie Huff, and it's great to have your company on the program today. Now, lucerne seed is a crop that South Australia does particularly well, and the price for certified lucerne seed has risen by almost 25% off the back of strong global demand. The last two seasons have seen average yields across smaller areas, and with many lucerne stands being used for fodder or hay instead of seed production, it means there's a bit of space in the market. And Josh Rashid, who is the chair of Lucerne Australia, told Karen Hunt there's very little seed available to fill that demand.
Yeah, demand's been really good this year and last year. Again, last year we had average harvest, but then at least probably half of the production area was out of the ground, so we didn't have a lot of seed to sell then. Came into this season for public lucerne seed, pretty well our cupboards were bare, so any contracts or sales that were made early would have been waiting for this seed to be harvested. So demand is strong, but also our supply is low. So those two things together have been good for the growers.
What's that done to prices?
Prices has been good. Started what I would consider to be quite reasonable on historical averages, good pricing for certified seed and even uncertified. Normally there's only a 30 to 50 cents difference from what certified and uncertified would get, with certified making a little bit more. Certified prices have jumped, I would say, close to 25% from when we started trading back in November, December, January for this year's harvest to where it is now. Uncertified, not as strong, still a slight jump, but hasn't had the demand that certified has. But that could possibly come if we continue with certified, which will be potentially sold out within a few months for public seed, which will only leave a bit of uncertified seed around.
Have you ever had a situation before where you've sold out this early in the season?
Not this early. Last year was, to a point, was similar. We sold out, but I would say a lot later. Demand this year, though, has been a lot stronger and more consistent. I've been in this job for 7, 8 years. I have not seen it where it's been so tight, and that from June, so probably July, August, I don't see that there'll be any public lucerne seed to sell other than maybe a little bit of uncertified. So,
Saudi Arabia has always been a big buyer of lucerne seed. Is that still the case, and are there any new markets opening up?
Saudi is still our number one market. Generally can take up to 50% of what we produce. So when they're buying, it makes a massive difference to our pricing and volume that we can sell. Argentina always used to be our second biggest market. That fell away for quite a few years, but last year we saw a big spike there, probably another nearly 100% on the year before that got sold into there, which is really strong, really good to see. US keeps buying a considerable amount. South Africa bought more than probably what was expected, especially uncertified seed, due to their harvest over there not being so strong. A lot of it hinges on what Saudi Arabia do because of the volume they can buy, but we've seen other markets still come in quite strong to what seed we have, so it's been good.
And do you expect that demand to continue as this year's crop comes out of the ground?
Potentially going into 2022 harvest. The cupboards should definitely be bare. If you're forward selling, it will be seed waiting to come off harvest. That, you know, hopefully gives us a good benchmark to start off for grower prices that might anticipate they'll stay strong. But again, we'll hinge on what our harvest is. A poor harvest and not a lot of seed, demand will be very strong. A stronger harvest might mean there's more seed to sell, but normally we have seed carry over. This year we won't, so as long as our demand stays where it is, I would expect it to be a pretty good season next year with any luck.
Good to hear some good news there from the Chair of Lucerne Australia, Josh Rashid, speaking to Karen Hunt. And staying in the southeast, a truck carrying cattle has rolled on a regional dirt road in the southeast, about 40 kilometres from Keith. The B-double rolled onto its side on Jip Jip Road at Petherick just before 9 o'clock this morning, and the driver was not injured in the crash. But police say it's unclear how many, if any, cattle have died, and emergency services are still working on a plan to get them out of the truck. So if we have more details, we'll let you know in the Country Hour. But first, we have to find out what's happening in weather across the state, given it is dominating the headlines in the eastern parts of the country. Simon Timke from the Bureau of Meteorology is with me. Good afternoon.
G'day, Cassie.
Well, it's definitely cold. I think my parents' place in New South Wales are getting to a top of 5 degrees today. So it's very cold in the east. But what are we seeing here in South Australia?
It is, you're right. The weather has been pretty interesting out to the east. I mean, looking at the satellite picture at the moment, we can see a lot of snow out over the ranges in the east there, and probably a bit more to come, and certainly plenty of wind and rainfall too. But for us in South Australia, that most of the action is over the east of our border, although we're sort of still in the southerly airstream on the western flank of that low, I guess, but not a lot left in the way of showers in that airstream for us. Looking on the radars at the moment, there's a little bit showing up on the Mount Lofty ranges and the sort of the southeastern slopes. And for the rest of today, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a light shower around that area, but also near southern coasts and possibly near the southeast coast of Eyre Peninsula and York Peninsula as well. They look to be very light showers. I can sort of see some out the window here looking back to the southeast, and they're very light, so the rainfall totals that we would get out of them would be not significant, so sort of nuisance value as much as anything. Further west, quite a bit of high cloud over the state, and generally light winds under a high pressure ridge there. That high pressure ridge is going to be a pretty slow moving feature for the next few days as it moves eastwards, and so we'll see generally light winds associated with that ridge, and anywhere where there's a bit of clear sky overnight will be reasonably cold as well. We had some pretty low minimum temperatures out to the northwest in particular this morning. Pukacha, Ernabella got down to -0.6, and a lot of places had a minimum temperature below 5 degrees, so pretty cold start, and similar sort of conditions to tomorrow morning in the north as well. So some frost patches possible about the pastoral and Flinders districts, maybe a little bit of morning fog about the agricultural area and south of the northwest pastoral district as well tomorrow. And other than that, for Friday, similar to today, where the light showers will be maybe a little bit further north tomorrow, but essentially just central and eastern parts of the agricultural area tomorrow. And again, not expecting anything in the way of big totals out of those showers. On Saturday, that ridge will continue to move eastward, so we'll have the cold morning a little bit further east on Saturday. So sort of the northeast pastoral district, maybe the Flinders district, will see some pretty low minimum temperatures. Showers, again for Saturday, just a slight to medium chance of light showers about the southern agricultural area, and a slight chance that we'll see some showers developing in the west ahead of the next trough that's approaching over the weekend. And then Sunday, similar sort of story, but a slight eastward movement of the showers. So generally talking about a slight to medium chance of showers across the south. And again, both Saturday and Sunday, not really expecting anything in the way of significant rainfall totals. On Monday, again, it's a similar sort of story, that sort of trough to the west moving slowly eastwards as the ridge moves away from us. So a slight chance of showers over the south of the pastoral district and the agricultural area, but a little bit more likely further west. So a medium chance over western and central parts of the agricultural area, and a higher chance near the west coast. So we'll see rainfall totals for that 4-day period out till midnight Monday, generally less than 2 millimetres, I think, but some local falls of 2 to 5 millimetres possible in the west, also about the southern Mount Lofty ranges and near the southeast coasts. And then on Tuesday and Wednesday, we'll see a more significant trough move across as a low-pressure system develops over the Bight. So they're probably our two best days of seeing rainfall, I think, because we'll see that slight to medium chance of showers continue in the south of the pastoral districts and the agricultural area, but during Tuesday, increasing to a very high chance of showers across the agricultural area, continuing into Wednesday, then contracting southwards during Thursday. So sort of not really anything in the way of significant rainfall totals until then, but Tuesday, Wednesday will be the days to keep an eye out for some more useful rainfall totals as that more dynamic sort of trough and low pressure system move across. So
is it going to be widespread?
Well, I think there's a pretty good chance over most of the agricultural area that there'll be something. So we'll be keeping a close eye on that one next week, Cassie, and if people are looking out for a bit more rain, Tuesday, Wednesday next week are probably the best 2 days.
Right, so we could follow up rain for some people. I think you mentioned it there, but there is a bit of a wind warning as well around today.
I cancelled that one at 10 o'clock. Yeah,
we did
have a strong wind warning out for the upper southeast coast and lower southeast coast. But as that low out to the east continues to move away, we've sort of seen those winds ease back a little bit. So still pretty fresh, still forecasting 20 to 25 knots on the waters, but below strong winds now.
Fair enough. Well, thanks so much for that. We'll keep in touch about what's coming rain-wise next week. Thanks for that, Simon.
Thanks, Cassie.
Simon Timkew from the Bureau of Meteorology speaking there. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be partly cloudy. There could be some areas of frost and maybe even some fog in the east in the morning. Overnight temperatures will fall to between 0 and 8 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach about 16 degrees. The lower western will be partly cloudy. Again, some frost and maybe some fog in the morning as well. Overnight there is going to get down to between minus 2 and 8 above 0. So pretty cold, but the daytime temperatures will get up to 14 to 17 degrees. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, I'm so glad you could join me today. This week I've had quite a lot of discussion on the program about this Australia-United Kingdom free trade agreement that could actually be finalised by the time the Prime Minister arrives at the G7 summit in England this weekend. There have been concerns raised by UK farmers that Australian animal husbandry is substandard, but a new survey has found that most Brits actually believe Australia has very high food safety and animal welfare standards, and they support the FTA.
Very strong levels of support for Australian wine, Australian lamb, beef. The majority of Brits say that they would like to be able to buy and purchase that more often and see it more often in British supermarkets. Most Brits want Australian beef to be the default alternative to British beef on British supermarkets.
So that's over the EU. I'm interested in doing our own survey here on the program. How do you feel about a free trade deal with the UK? Are there any UK products you'd like to see more of in Australia? You can text me on 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. You also might remember that last week the world's largest meat processor, JBS, was brought to a standstill when its computer systems were shut down globally. So that includes the Bordertown and Port Wakefield facilities in South Australia. Soon I'll reveal just what it took to get that multinational company back up and running. And I'll be interested to know what you think about what they've done. But first of all, we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Glemacek. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this hour, the Prime Minister Scott Morrison says Australia's international border will remain shut as long as it's in the country's national and economic interest. The border was closed in March of last year in response to the pandemic, and it's expected to remain closed until at least the middle of next year. The government's been under pressure to outline what it will take for the border to reopen. Mr. Morrison's told 6PR he'll be guided by the medical advice but doesn't want to jeopardise the gains that Australia's made. There's been a privacy breach affecting the Home Builder Grant. Treasurer Rob Lucas says because of human error, thousands of email addresses of applicants have been accidentally revealed to other people who applied for the money in an email sent by a government department here. Another email was sent to recall the original one, but it also had everyone's email details visible. And AusNet says it could take days before some homes get their power back as a result of Victoria's wild weather overnight. More than 210,000 Victorian homes and businesses remain without power as heavy rain and fallen trees have damaged power lines right across the state. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, the world's largest meat processor, JBS, has confirmed it paid hackers a $14 million ransom to regain access to their computer operations. Now, that ransom was actually paid in Bitcoin, and it was made after a cyber attack was launched on the company's computer systems last week, and it led to a temporary shutdown of abattoirs around the world, including here in South Australia at Bordertown and Port Wakefield. Nikolai Balhart spoke with Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets and began by asking if he was actually surprised that JBS paid up.
Oh, look, to a degree, yes, because the narrative, Nikolai, often is don't pay ransoms. You know, a lot of people say we don't pay ransoms, but then to come out and admit that it's been paid is even more surprising. The fact, A, they paid it, then B, they've admitted to it. But I guess it's becoming commonplace, though, where they probably had limited choice.
It just seems like such a large amount of money as well. I guess in the scheme of the scale of JBS, maybe it's not that much, but it seems like a lot of money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they're a big entity and certainly, you know, they've probably got the capacity to pay a figure like that. But, you know, like I said, it's with the rise of things like cryptocurrency, it's making it easier for this type of ransom to be successful. In the past, it was much harder to, get the money paid, you know, whether it was in cash or into an account, whereas nowadays with the lack of, I guess, traceability, it's really, we're seeing a big growth in this kind of style of ransomware attack.
And is there some concern that it helps kind of set that precedent of, you know, that often quoted line of, you know, well, we don't negotiate with terrorists or with people that are holding us to ransom, but now it seems a lot of people do.
Yeah, I think it does, and that's the other aspect I was saying before, the fact that it's been, you know, fairly widely published, and you know that they've paid the ransom. I think it does set a bit of a dangerous precedent.
Is food processing particularly vulnerable in this space because of the timeliness and because of supply chains that really do rely on continuity and continuity of supply?
Yeah, look, I guess any business, and we're talking about a lot, not just in the food supply space, but, you know, that just-in-time style of inventory, you know, in food in particular, you know, meat product that's perishable, you've only got a limited amount of time that you can have any downtime, really. So it impacts your business significantly. But there's a lot of businesses that would be using that style of inventory where if they are offline for a day or two, it becomes incredibly problematic for the cash flow of the business.
Should this be of concern to smaller Australian producers? Maybe not the, you know, the JBSs of the world, but smaller businesses or even sole traders that probably don't have a dedicated IT team. Should they be worried?
Look, I think if part of it would be capacity to pay as well. So, you know, to be a target, I mean, any business should have, you know, significantly, you know, kind of good systems for their IT and for cybersecurity. You'd be foolish not to have, you know, systems in place. But I think it's probably those businesses that on the hit list of these types of criminals, international networks, would be, you know, those larger types, I think, that would have the capacity to pay and could be severely disrupted. So like your JBSs of the world, the smaller operators, maybe they just wouldn't, you know, appear on the criminal's radar potentially, but I think it is a wake-up call for any business to make sure that they're as safe as they can be in terms of their cyber security and their access to their networks.
And just while we've got you on a different topic, I guess we've been talking about some of the challenges of the market, but on a different front, the market seems to be charging ahead anyway. The Ecchi's just hit another high.
Yeah, that's right. It drifted off a little bit last few weeks, but it's been in a pretty significant uptrend since, I guess, the start of the season. So we just saw it reach above. So 910 was the previous high a few months back, and it's just touched 912 today. So, look, not uncommon to see with the winter period with prices tending to grind higher. So I guess the next point is that 936 is the all-time inflation adjusted high. So that's probably a reasonable level to see if we can get to.
That was Matt Dalglish, Manager of Commodity Market Insights at Thomas Elder Market, speaking there. He mentioned the Ecchi, it's the young cattle price indicator. It gives you an idea of what beef could cost at the supermarket or perhaps at your butcher as well. Now, the ABC did invite JBS on for an interview, but they declined and instead referred us to a statement from their US office. But they did say that they paid that $14 million ransom to the hackers. So should they have done that? There is that line, you don't negotiate with terrorists, and not just them specifically, but should businesses pay cyber hackers to get their systems back online? Do they have any choice in the matter if they want to keep operating? I'd be interested to know what you think about this. You can text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. We do live in a globalised world with multinational companies, and it does mean that trade flows across borders. And we've been talking about this a bit this week, and despite some concerns that we have heard about UK farmers complaining about the standards of Australian welfare, animal welfare, a new survey has shown that there is actually widespread support for a free trade deal between the UK and Australia, and that could be finalised in the next couple of days. Now, the survey done by the free market think tank, the Adam Smith Institute, has found that two-thirds of Brits would support a free trade deal with Australia, even if it meant increased competition for British farmers and that some might go out of business. Head of research at CT Group and a fellow with the Adam Smith Institute, Dr. Michael Turner, he's here to explain some more of the findings. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Just so people know where you're coming from, what is the Adam Smith Institute and CT Group?
Yeah, so I'm obviously head of research for the research and strategy business CT Group based in Australia, and I'm also a fellow of the Adam Smith Institute. So the Adam Smith Institute is a free market think tank, and that's based in the UK, in London.
So coming at this from a rather pro-free trade point of view, you surveyed Australians and Brits on how they would feel about a UK free trade deal. What are some of the biggest takeaways you've got?
Clearly, the biggest takeaway is just the sheer level of support for, you know, free trade and for getting this deal done, both in the UK and in Australia. So more than two-thirds of Brits and Aussies support this deal, and the UK is number one on the list as a priority to do more trade with for Australians, and Australia is number one on the list for as a priority to do more trade with for Brits.
Drilling down into some of those numbers, though, we have heard in recent weeks that there has been a bit of nervousness from the UK livestock producers, in particular sheep and cattle producers, about Australian meat, beef and lamb being imported into the country. When you look at perhaps more commodity-specific numbers, what sort of support is there in the UK for Australian produce going into the country?
So very strong levels of support for Australian wine, Australian lamb, beef. The majority of Brits say that they would like to be able to buy and purchase that more often and see it more often in British supermarkets. And actually, you know, to that point that you raised earlier on about you know, whether or not there's support for seeing more Australian lamb or not in the UK market, there's very clear support for that. And actually, in fact, most Brits want Australian beef to be the default alternative to British beef on British supermarkets.
How do the Britons you surveyed feel about Australia's animal welfare and food safety, given this is an issue that has been raised by the Farmers Federation in the UK?
At the heart of these findings is an interesting trend, which is that the more people want to, the more that British voters feel standards are high, the more they want to trade with that country. And Australia is actually in that elite club in the eyes of Brits that has very high standards. A very large proportion of Brits feel that Australia has high levels of animal welfare and standards of produce as well. And because of that, there is a really strong relationship which says that we would like to trade with Australia more.
There's been less backlash in Australia. If you look at the trade coming the other way, what sort of support has there been in Australia for Australia to be trading more with the UK?
It's remarkable, actually, how similar these results are. I think one of the key points of the research is that there is very similar levels of support among Australians for the deal as there are among Brits. Certainly things like British cheese, shortbread, jam and marmalade, even the Cornish pasty, the famous Cornish pasty, made down in Cornwall in England. There's high levels of support. A majority of voters would like to see more jam and marmalade from the UK and cheese, and many would like to see Scottish whisky as well. So I think there is obviously a great deal of support, you know, among Brits, but what was surprising is that equally as many Australians support British produce coming over as well, and they say they would like to see more choice. And, you know, we also asked them about cars and whether they'd like to see more British manufacturers as part of the mix in Australia, and, you know, more than two-thirds of Australians said that they would actually like to see more British options, and they would consider them also when they are thinking about making their next car purchase.
This free trade agreement obviously extends beyond food and beverage trade. When you look at other issues at play when countries are negotiating a free trade agreement, what are some of the other findings you've uncovered through this survey?
This thing goes, in the eyes of Brits, way beyond just produce also. It's also focused on workers. And it's very clear that Brits, you know, see Australian workers as high standards, very professional. We asked this question about whether or not they would trust, you know, being treated by an Australian nurse. And overwhelming majority, 91%, 92% of Brits say that they would trust being treated by an Australian nurse. And they don't think that they should have to requalify to be able to work in the UK. And that's sort of symptomatic about sort of the way that Brits see Australians. They feel that they are hard workers, but they also kind of trust them and their standards as professionalism.
Do you think that the agricultural trade issues will be enough to hold up the UK-Australia FTA?
No, I don't. And there's two reasons why. Firstly, is that the overwhelming support to be able to kind of build further economic relations with Australia is clear from these results. But secondly, is a unique thing in these data that show Brits back British farmers to see this as an opportunity to grow their businesses and to innovate and to compete globally, as do Australians for Australian farmers. And so, you know, while there may be a few voices that suggest that are cautious about this deal, it's actually British consumers who fully back their own farmers to seize the opportunity that this deal puts in front of them.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what comes out of the G7 meetings this weekend and next week as to whether or not this deal does get signed off. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Turner, the head of research for CT Group, a research and strategy consultancy based in Australia. He's also a fellow of the Adam Smith Institute. And if there are perhaps products that you'd like to see with an FTA, maybe there's some more Cornish pasties or something like that in Australia, I'd love to know. Text me 0467 922 891. I have also had a text in on the ransomware, the ransom, the $14 million ransom that was paid by JBS to hackers last week to get their company up and running. Jesse from Mitcham says that ransomware, best protection is an offline backup. Next best, be really careful about attachments, but anyone can be fooled, Jesse says. Often it looks like a real bill from your utility company. It is remarkable how sophisticated some of the attachments things that can trick you into divulging information can be. Interested in whether you think that ransom should have been paid, text me 0467 922 891 or phone 1300 222 891. Soon I'll have more on a new apple variety you could see on your shelves. There's already a lot of variety in the apple space, but there's another one coming. Right now though, it is 14 minutes to one.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
Could we raise money with guaranteed income from these lotteries to fund the heritage that many of us so love? Darren Peacock is Chief Executive Officer of the National Trust.
No reason why we can't do it in Australia, and it's disappointing that we haven't.
Why do you think it's not being run with?
In South Australia, I believe we have a problem in that the lotteries were sold off, including the right to actually run public lotteries.
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Gearing schools in Australia are recording a boom in new students lured by higher than normal paychecks. The national award rate for shearing of $3.25 per head of sheep hasn't actually changed, but many farmers and contractors are paying shearers a premium just so they can secure workers. Now, Tiffany Atzi runs a shearing contracting business with her husband near Pinneroo in the east of South Australia, and she experienced firsthand the struggle to secure shearers, particularly in the last year with the troubles with borders and getting people in from overseas. And she says they need to be paid more for the tough work they're doing.
It's been an interesting area working in the shearing industry in that the wages have increased quite substantially for shearers and has made it far more attractive to come and take up a handpiece. So we've actually had some local shearers that have, you know, gone on to do other work and have actually come back in as shearers now. They've discovered their love for shearing again and have come back on board and asked for work. And we've also been attracting some new shed hand staff as well, which has been really fantastic, and that gets more people back into the industry. So the wage increase that has occurred because of the shortage is seeing a positive light in that area in that, yeah, more people are actually considering shearing as a career option. So we are looking okay at the moment, but we are definitely planning to spread out the shearing as much as possible.
Do you welcome the increase in wages and actually seeing more local community members turning to the shearing industry?
Definitely. We see it as a huge positive. The award rate on shearing has had gradual increases for a very long time, and it hasn't reflected the workload that is taken on by a shearer. They are shearing bigger and bigger sheep every year. It's taking a bigger toll on their bodies. It is seeing, you know, more and more leave the industry because it is just getting very difficult to shear the large sheep. And it's not even just the size. It's just we have sheep that are fed so well now, so they're stronger. So not only are they bigger, they are stronger sheep. They really have a lot of oomph behind them, and it's a lot, and it takes a real toll. And we have seen more injuries in our staff, which has been really, really sad to see. And we try to manage that as much as best we can. There's only so much we can do as a contractor, but we try to, you know, get the rest time that they need, if possible, which was really hard last year. But, yeah, we see that it's been recognised that shearers are worth their money. They are worth a lot. They are doing really, really hard work on farms, and it is keeping these farmers' livelihoods going. So we really welcome that this sort of change is happening. We're also seeing change in farmers recognising that they need to provide workplace safety. They need to really look at their sheds and what has been provided. You know, is there running water? Is there toilets? COVID was a blessing in some ways because farmers who didn't have running orders at sheds that, you know, they had to provide proper hand washing facilities for our shearers. So there's things like that, you know, basic, just a tap on a tank that, you know, wasn't available at some sheds, and it is an essential, it has become essential thanks to COVID. So we're just welcoming the change in attitude, really, of we need to look after our shearers. They are valuable. They are doing really, really hard work to keep, you know, a whole industry running. And so we need to, you know, actually pay them what they're worth and make sure that we can keep them in the industry, keep them healthy, and, you know, keep their enthusiasm that they have for this job. So, no, we've welcomed every step of the way.
While the national award rate of $3.25 per sheep hasn't changed, many farmers and contractors are paying shearers a premium to keep them in the industry. Jason Letchford is the secretary of the Shearing Contractors Association in Australia, and he says shearing schools are recording a real boom in local newcomers.
We've had a great, probably the best response ever in terms of looking at new markets, as in people who work in, you know, metropolitan areas, be it Adelaide, Melbourne, Sydney. They're far more aware due to, you know, the publicity getting around about the shearer shortage, and we've had lots of inquiries from those, you know, non-traditional sources of labour. And as a result, we're seeing all our shearing schools being oversubscribed. You know, normally in a year for South Australia and Victoria, we might run around 20 shearing schools. This sort of 12-month period, we're going to run around mid-40s. You know, I think the last count, there's about 43 shearing schools that have gone on in this for this period of time. And we're seeing a lot of those shearing schools being filled up very quickly. And then through social media, we're putting a sort of the next school on the next week, which wouldn't normally happen. And again, they're sort of oversubscribed very quickly. So there's a few things going on here. The industry's done a much better job of promoting the need for workers. And it's also done a much better job in terms of, you know, retraining those workers and getting them into jobs straight away. That's been one of the silver linings of the whole COVID-19 pandemic.
Now, given that it has been such a good season for lambing, are you expecting coming into peak season in spring to have enough workers?
No, I don't think anyone's expecting we will have enough workers. It's very much a conversation at the moment that, you know, you know, wool growers, lamb producers, they can't instantly change their cycles of when they shear and when they lamb. But it's definitely a conversation that shearing contractors are having with growers at the moment that they need to, those who don't necessarily need to shear in spring need to really seriously consider moving. If they want to have a labour force and have their sheep shorn in a timely manner, like when they kind of want it to have done, then that they need to have a serious think about their cycles and when they do it. Because if you're going to be a wool or a fat lamb producer and want to have instant gratification, in other words, have those animals tended to and shorn when you want them to, we're still going to struggle in this spring, even with, you know, the re-arrival of the Kiwis.
Jason Letchford, Secretary of the Shearing Contractors Association of Australia, finishing that story by Jessica Schremer. And I've had a text in on that previous story on the UK-Australia Free Trade Agreement. Greg says, after the horrible TPP attempt, I don't trust FTAs until all the details are released. Thanks so much for getting in touch there, Greg. Yeah, you can keep the conversation going, 0467922891 or phone 1300 222 891. We have had a call in to say that there is a car on fire at the top of Greenhill Road, and that road is possibly closed. I'd say probably just stay away from that part of the hills for the meantime. The CFS is attending. That is at the Greenhill Yannigan Road and Mount Lofty Summit Road. So stay clear at the moment, because the CFS is attending to a car on fire at the top of Greenhill Road. Finally today, though, apples. There seems to be a new variety coming out every year, but an apple growing in Tasmania is investing upwards of $15 million on a new variety that is not yet named. So I can't tell you what it's called, but David Barnett-Clement met grower Andrew Smith in a secret orchard in the Huon Valley where some of these trees have been planted.
This is a bit of a sacred site. We've moved out here to get some water security on the Huon River here, and yeah, we're tucked away on the edge of the southwest of Tasmania.
Okay, so Andrew Smith, we're here in this new orchard surrounded by new trees of a new variety of apple. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. You're standing in a block of Kazuri apples on 26 rootstock. There's 9,000 trees in this block and they're all like little soldiers lined up, and this is a new variety that we're hoping to commercialise in Australia in the next few years.
So the variety came out of Belgium. It's the only commercial variety of the, well, it's only commercial standing of this variety here in Australia.
Yeah, we purchased the commercial license to have this variety. Went to Better Three Fruits in Belgium and saw this apple and put a proposal to them to own the commercial rights in Australia, because we were really attracted to many of the characteristics about this apple and thought that it could help to grow the Australian apple market.
So tell me about the apple. Give me a description. What's it like?
It's a cross between a Golden Delicious and an unnamed New York State variety. It's scab resistant, so it has some disease resistance characteristics. It's very attractive. Has a beautiful Golden Delicious background, but a red apple colour over the outside. It's conical. It's quite attractive, but above all else, it's a low input apple that has great storability. And like all new varieties coming into the market, it's very, very crisp and has great flavour.
It looks a little bit to me like a pink lady almost. What's the flavour profile like? If you're a consumer, what are you going to taste when you have a bite?
Yeah, so the flavour profile, of course, is enormously important, and it's really difficult, as you can imagine. There's millions of new apple varieties out there and we're trying to pick one that we think can make it in the market. It doesn't taste like a pink lady. It's not as acid as a pink lady, but it's not as sweet as a gala. So it's right in the middle there. It has relatively high sugar, but it doesn't come through in the flavour. And the thing that I'm attracted to and hopefully will work for us is it's a very unique flavour.
And cooking, eating, bit of both, all over?
Everything. You know, apples are pretty good fruit. They're good for everything. It's not just the Granny Smith that you can cook with. You can cook with all apples, and this is no different. So, and obviously for all the new apple varieties coming onto the market, as I said, we're trying to excite the market with a better product, not an inferior product. So I think you'll find all these apples are a step up from what we currently have.
So a bit of a utility fruit all-rounder.
Absolutely.
Now, we've got 9,000 trees here, and everything's looking quite new, but you're planning to put in a lot more than 9,000.
Yeah, so obviously we want to make a mark in the market, and we want to get the fruit out there. So our long-term plan between now and 2028 is to plant 300,000 trees, and that's a considerable investment. As part of that, we have to put the trees, as you can see in the ground here, there's trees and poles and wires and infrastructure and irrigation, and then it involves building more storage, buying more apple bins, and having the capacity to handle that fruit once it comes in. So it's a once-in-a-lifetime investment for a business like ours. And
what's the numbers like? So 300,000 trees, what does it translate into in terms of dollars?
About $15 million worth of investment from between, we started 4 years ago now, so from 4 years ago till 2028. So it's not an insignificant amount of money, and it just proves once again that we put it all on black.
Yeah, well, that is quite a bit of cash. What's this going to do in terms of your operation? How much larger will your total orchard size become?
It'll make us 30 to 40% larger in the short term in the next couple of years. And if the consumers take this off the shelf, it will continue to grow our business and grow opportunity down here in the Huon Valley. We'll employ more people and spend more money and do all those things. So it's going to accelerate the growth that we've got in our fresh apple business. And that's a commitment that my father and I have now made to the business.
That seems like a huge step in a particular direction with this one apple variety. Mm-hmm. You're confident that consumers will pick it off the shelf?
No, David, I'm not. We're never confident. There is a significant amount of risk in what we're doing. Genuinely, we had to make an educated decision whether this was the right apple and this was the way we wanted to go, and really sit down around the table, my father and I and our families, and talk about whether this was an investment we wanted to make or we didn't have to do it. But, you know, we're going to have a crack. And if we do put this apple out there and it does have some success, what it means is that we get to control it.
Apple grower Andrew Smith. Farmers, they're the ultimate gamblers. So hopefully the gamble pays off. That's all we have time for in the program, but just keep listening to your ABC local radio where Sonia Feldhoff will be on. Hi, Sonia.
Hello. Yes. Should we be having lights on our roads all the time in your cars? RAA wants it for cyclists. Should we all be doing it?
I guess probably a few variables there, but interesting chat. Thanks for that, Sonia. Keep listening to your ABC local radio. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for news.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.